Sunday, 28th of July. The house feels quiet without Roxy, without Nathan, without her mother. Just her and the children on a long, overcast Sunday. Roxy had messaged her earlier from the hospital to say that Erin was still unconscious, still wired up, still in a critical condition. And all around her, the news is breaking like a slow, shocking tsunami. The awfulness of it is too big for Alex to fully process. Her sisters message her constantly. They should be WhatsApping now about their upcoming holiday. They should be sharing pictures of new dresses bought and asking for reading recommendations, asking if the villa has hairdryers, making reservations for dinner as it's impossible to seat that many people in a restaurant without advance planning. Alex should be trying on swimwear in the mirror in her room that has a rear view and wondering if she could still get away with the bikini at 45 and then thinking that, God, yes, of course she could, and if she couldn't now, then when could she? And she would suck in her stomach and turn this way and that and think, not bad, not bad at all for a middle-aged mother of two. That's what she should be doing now. Instead, she is trapped in a gothic, tick-tocking, slow-burn nightmare. So she is quite glad of the distraction at around 2 o'clock that long, never-ending Sunday when Pat O'Neill calls her from the hospital and says, Roxy's been telling me about your podcast, about the things that Josie told you. I just think, Alex, for the sake of balance and truth, that I should come in and talk to you, tell you my side of the story, because I know you think I was probably a bad mother, and in many ways, I was. But honestly, you need to understand Josie properly, what she's really like, before you can even hope to make any sense of what's been going on. Can you come now? Alex says. And then she gives Pat her address and sits in the kitchen and waits for her to arrive.
This is the voice of Pat O'Neill talking to Alex Summer on the 28th of July 2019.
It's true, I was not ready to be Josie's mother, not ready at all. I was coming to the end of the second year of my degree in social anthropology. I was at my peak. I felt so alive, so vibrant. I just wanted to keep going, keep ploughing on, see how far I could get. And then I got pregnant. And because I didn't show, I had no idea until it was too late to do anything about it. Josie's father was long gone by then. I can't even remember his surname to this day. Isn't that awful? I think it began with a K. Kelly, maybe? Anyway, Josie arrived and I was not ready. No, I wasn't ready to be a mother, but mainly, I was not ready for Josie. She was a dark child. And yes, maybe that was partly to do with me, with my style of mothering. I wanted her to be independent. I wanted her to be strong and impressive. Probably left her to her own devices too much. It's important, though, for children to make their own mistakes and learn from them. It's not good to never let your kids fuck up. But she was so needy. So needy. I gave her as much as I could, but it was never enough. And it wasn't just me. She did it with her friends. I saw it happen time after time. She was a brooding presence in social situations. It was almost as if she spent her whole life just waiting for someone to show her that they didn't want her. She pushed so many friends away over the smallest thing. And as for me ever having a boyfriend, I'll forget it. Seriously, forget it. She turned psycho whenever she thought a man might encroach on our lives. She would play cruel tricks on him, insult them, pretend to be ill if I was going out on a date. She even made a voodoo doll once, I kid you not. I mean, where did she even get the idea from? But yeah, she made one of a man I was seeing and left it lying around the flat with pins sticking out of it when he came round to see me. So all of them upped and left, of course they did. And then I started seeing Walter.
I'm sorry.
I started dating Walter. When Josie was about 13.
Josie didn't tell me that.
Well, no, of course she didn't, because she only told you what she wanted you to know, what suited her weird narrative. And that's exactly why I'm here talking to you, you see? Because Josie didn't tell you lots of things, and Josie's run off letting the whole world think that her husband was a monster, that he groomed her, that he abused his children, and the world needs to know that's rubbish. You need to know that's rubbish. Walter Fair was far from perfect. He was quite controlling, liked things done his way. He was quite full of himself, yes, and obviously I knew it was wrong that we were having an affair behind his wife's back. Of course I knew that. But he was a loving man, a real man. He just wanted to love and to be loved. He just wanted a quiet life. And what we had was very real, very intense, and I was prepared to wait it out until he found the right time to leave his wife. At first, Josie was very resistant to him, as she was with all my boyfriends. But then, as she got older, she seemed to become fixated on him. She would try to divert his attention away from me and onto herself. She would put makeup on when he came over and say disparaging things about me, about how old I was, about how fat I was. At first, Walter and I used to joke about it together. But then the joke stopped around the time Josie turned 16. And then, just after she turned 18, they told me.
So you didn't know? You didn't know that they were together before that?
Obviously, I should have known. As Josie's mother, I should have known. And I take full responsibility for the fact that I dropped the ball. I was so desperate for Josie to be independent, to have her own life. I just wanted... And I know how bad this sounds, but I wanted her to be somewhere else. Not at home. I hated it when she was at home. She cast this mood, this atmosphere. I didn't want to talk to her. I didn't... God save my soul... I didn't like her. So I never asked her where she'd been, what she'd been doing. I didn't want to know. I was just happy that I didn't have to deal with her. But God, the shock when I found out. The pure horror of it. And you know, when Walter and I were together, Josie used to tell me I was disgusting for being with a married man. And then she went right in there and snatched him away from his wife and from me.
So... In your opinion, Walter didn't groom Josie.
Groom her? You mean manipulate her into a relationship with him? No, I don't think so. I think she saw him, she wanted him, she got him. She didn't care who she hurt. She's never cared who she hurt. She's... And this is a terrible thing to say about your own child, and obviously I've been far from perfect myself, but I really think Josie has a heart of stone. A heart of pure stone.
Six p.m. For a while after Pat leaves, Alex feels numb. Her mother comes over and cooks something for the children to eat, serves it to them, sits with them while they eat it, listens to their chatter, creates a sense of calm and peace which Alex is currently incapable of doing. I think he's dead, she says to her mother when they're alone together in the garden later on. Her mother looks at her with concern and says, No, surely not. No, he is. I can feel it. All this time I've been thinking that Josie was weird because Josie was damaged. All this time I've been thinking she was crying out for help somehow, that she needed me. But now I realise she was never crying out for help. She never needed me. She did have a plan, though. The whole time. And I was just a cog. And so was Nathan. But why? Why would she want to hurt Nathan? She barely knew him. Look, she made it clear to me that she thought very little of Nathan, that she thought I'd be better off without him. She even asked me once how I'd feel if he died, and then seemed really disappointed when I said that I would be sad. And when she first suggested that I should make a podcast about her, she pretty much told me that she was embarking on a project of change and that she wanted me to document it. You think all this was deliberate? I don't know how exactly, but yes, I think it was. I mean, she obviously knew that Erin had all that money in her bank account and then somehow found a way to get her PIN, to extract all that cash, to pay someone, to lure Nathan to that hotel. She knew that Nathan was going to be out that night because he told her, and, you know, when she left that day, I was surprised about how easily she went, how she didn't make a fuss or try to stay. And now I know it was part of the plan too. And I really think she took him to kill him, Mum. I really do. Every second we're sitting here is a second lost for Nathan. And I don't know what to do, Mum. I just don't know what to do.
Tim and Angel Hiddingfold Clark are the current owners of Josie's dog, Fred.
We genuinely had no idea that Josie was a wanted woman. We'd been enjoying our honeymoon, hadn't watched any TV, read any news. It wasn't until we started messaging our friends about this crazy thing that had just happened, this woman giving us her dog, that we started getting replies going, you know that might be the woman that the police are looking for. And we were like, what woman? And then we went onto the internet and saw the photos of the woman, Josie, and yeah, it was her. And yes, of course, we went straight to the police. Absolutely.
We got a call from the Cumbria Constabulary on Saturday the 27th. They'd had a call from a couple of holidaymakers who'd been handed a small dog to take care of a couple of days before. They said the photographs of Josie Fair they'd seen online matched the woman who'd handed them the dog. They said this all occurred in broad daylight in an area busy with tourists. They said it happened in a flash. But they were able to give us more of an idea of what Josie was wearing, that she was trying to disguise her appearance with a hood and sunglasses. They said that she left heading towards the main village of Ambleside, carrying a small handbag. We immediately started a street-to-street, house-to-house investigation. It wasn't until very late on Sunday that we had a breakthrough. A family dining in a restaurant in the village told us that a woman matching Josie's appearance with a small dog had been staying at their lodge park. They said she'd arrived the previous Sunday in the middle of the day and had gone by Thursday morning. We contacted the management and they confirmed that yes, Mrs. Fair had booked a lodge online 2 weeks earlier. They told us that the lodges were accessed via a key code and that they had not had cause to meet with Mrs. Fair face to face and that they were unaware that she'd left the park on Thursday as her booking went all the way through to the following weekend and she'd not notified them that she had checked out. We dispatched the team there immediately and entered the lodge just before midnight on Sunday night.
Water rescue team are going in. I repeat, water rescue team are going in. Stand by.
...11 p.m. Roxy calls Alex that night, just after Alex has climbed into bed. How's Erin? Still nothing, says Roxy, but they say her vitals are improving all the time. They reckon she'll wake up within the next few hours. What about you? Have you heard anything? Not yet. I suppose it's getting a bit late now, but hopefully tomorrow. Alex pauses. Your grandma told me about her and your dad today. That Walter used to be her boyfriend. Ugh, yeah, I know. Gross, isn't it? The whole thing. Oh, my family. I'm sorry. Sorry? What for? Sorry you got involved. Sorry she dragged you in. Sorry you ever had to know about any of it. It was my choice, Roxy. I went to her, remember? I didn't have to go to the alteration shop that day. I didn't have to agree to her suggestion to make a podcast. I didn't have to let her stay here after she claimed your dad had hit her. I could have pulled the plug on it at any moment. But I let myself be controlled by her. It was all me, ultimately. All of it. There's a short, pensive silence, and then Roxy says, "What was it about my mum? Why did you want to do it?" Alex stops and gives the question some thought. Then she says, "Honestly, I think I was bored, Roxy. I think I was bored, and I was having problems with my husband. I was filled with anger and resentment, with this low-level rage. And your mum came along with her stories that made my problems pale in comparison. And I think it just stopped me focusing on the shit in my own life. That's all it was. A distraction. I overrode all my instincts when I said yes. And I think I did that deliberately. Because I've been following my instincts for so long and making good decisions for so long. And a bit of me just wanted to see what would happen if I ignored them. If I was a bit reckless. You know, like when you're driving down windy roads and you deliberately close your eyes for a second, just to see what happens. So that's what I did. And now, well, here we are." They end the call, and Alex slowly places the phone on her bedside table. She's about to pick up her book when the scream of a fox disturbs her. She gets out of bed and walks to the window seat overlooking the garden. Here she pulls her feet up under her and watches for a while as two foxes play in the garden in the warm moonlight. She and Nathan have sat here together before, watching foxes through the window, and she feels the echoes of those moments running through her from her head to her feet. Nathan in boxers, toothbrush in his mouth, coming over to sit next to her. The smell of him. What was it? A sort of solid smell. Like cars, like books, like trees. And the sheen of the skin on his back. And the reassuring feel of his weight next to hers in the bed, which, even though she always fantasized about having her own room, she always appreciated. And then she remembers a moment a few weeks ago, in the recording studio with Josie, when Josie had been telling her the untrue story of how she and Walter had got together, and she remembers Josie saying, "Well, as we're birthday twins, it's only fair that you should tell me about when you met Nathan. What was it like? Where did you meet him?" Alex quickly pulls on her dressing gown and heads quietly through the house and out into the garden where the foxes stare at her boldly for a moment before disappearing into the foliage. She unlocks the doors to her recording studio and puts on her headphones, searches through the recordings until she finds the one she's looking for. And there is Josie's voice, that odd, hollow voice with no inflection and emotion, asking Alex, "Where did you meet him?" And Alex's reply follows.
This is a recording from Alex Summers' podcast, captured in June 2019.
I was almost 30 when we met. I was starting to worry that I was never going to meet anyone. I was working in publishing at the time. It's a notoriously girl-heavy industry. The chances of meeting anyone were slim to zero. I was living with my sister, Zoe. We were perennially single. Zoe was 2 years older than me and had already given up. But I still felt like he was out there, you know? I could smell him almost, hear him coming. So I just kept putting myself out there. Time after time after time. But nothing. No one.
I can't believe that. A beautiful woman like you.
It's not how it works. Trust me, it isn't. And then one night, just before my 30th birthday. I was on my way home and I was drunk and I remembered that I had something to collect from the dry cleaners. I'd been meaning to pick it up for weeks, but for some reason I chose 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night when I'd just had half a bottle of wine and a gin and tonic to do it. And there was this guy in front of me collecting shirts, bright red hair, taller than me. Nice shirt, nice body. But it was the voice. That was the first thing. This voice, so confident, but not arrogant. Just a really good voice. And then when he'd paid, he turned round and I saw this face. I can't explain it. I saw this face and I thought, it's you. It's you. Like I'd already met him. Like someone had already told me about him. But of course, nobody had. Nobody had told me. I just knew. I said something cringy, like, that's a lot of shirts. And he stopped and looked at me, and I was drunk, and he was sober. And I think he just thought he'd play with me a bit. And he said, yes, I eat a lot of shirts. And then I said, sorry, I'm a bit drunk. And he said, yes, I know. And he just looked at me, and his eyes were this colour. I don't even know if there's a word for it. Just the most incredible shade of nothing. And I got my dry cleaning and he took me to the pub. And that was that. 2 years later, we were married. A year after that, I was pregnant with Eliza.
Do you still love him?
Of course, yes.
But, like, really love him? Like you did back then in the dry cleaners? When you didn't know anything about him?
It's a different kind of love, but yes, I do.
You don't ever think that your life would be better if you were on your own?
No. No, I don't.
And yet you call yourself a feminist?
Yes, I do, and I am. You can be happily married and a feminist.
I don't think so. I think that you can only be a feminist if you're single.
Oh, that's an interesting counterpoint. Can you elaborate?
I shouldn't need to, Alex. You should understand what I'm saying. You have to be free in order to be in control, Alex. You have to be free. No baggage. A clean break. Like your friend Marie Lejeune said. The one from your podcast. Remember what she said about clean breaks? Remember?
This is the voice of Marie Lejeune, the subject of one of Alex Summer's previous podcasts from her series, All Woman.
And as awful as it sounds, death is a clean break. There are no grey areas, no ambiguity. It's like a blank canvas in a way.
Don't you ever think, Alex, that everything would be easier if they were dead?
...12:45 a.m. Alex presses stop and pulls off her headphones. She leans back into her chair, lets her head roll back and exhales loudly. There it was. There it was all along. She hadn't got it at the time. She'd had no recollection of what Marie Lejeune had said about clean breaks and death. She'd thought Josie was rambling. But really, she'd been giving her her warped manifesto, laying it out for Alex to see, and she totally missed it. This, Alex realizes now, was what Josie had wanted to share with Alex when she approached her outside the children's school with that slightly desperate air about her. She'd had a revelation, and she wanted Alex to be the depository for it. And she'd shown it to her during this interview, and Alex had blown it. She'd totally blown it. She thumps her fists against the studio desk and cries out in rage and frustration at her own stupidity. Stupid! So stupid! And then she pulls herself together when she hears the ringtone coming from her phone and sees DC Albright's number on the screen. She glances at the time. It's nearly 1 a.m. Her stomach rolls over and she breathes in until her lungs are full. Then she presses answer and waits for Sabrina to speak. The drive is endless. The children are at Maxine's and it is now almost 2 in the morning. Alex thinks back to Sabrina's words on the phone, what feels like a lifetime ago but was only 1.5 hours. He was definitely here, Alex. It looks like he was held by force in the lodge. There's evidence of restraint, of struggle, and there are tracks leading down to the lake. So what we're doing, Alex, is we're going to launch a water rescue operation right now. We're also going to be sending boats out across the whole lake in case they've taken off on water. I think, Alex, you should make your way up here as soon as you possibly can. Is there anyone who can drive you? She and her mother have been on the road for 1 hour and they're barely out of London. Alex feels jittery and hollow. She hasn't eaten all day. All that is in her stomach is the glass of wine she had with her mother in the garden at 9 o'clock. She should eat, but she can't eat. And she doesn't want to stop for food and make this journey take any longer than it already is. She scrolls through her phone mindlessly, aimlessly, painfully. She looks at all the messages that she's been sent over the past few days from people she hasn't seen or thought about for years and years, but who all love her and care about her. And she wants to reply to them all, but she cannot. She doesn't know what words there are or how to arrange them or what use it would be anyway. So she shuts down her messages and stares instead into the darkness of the night. The occasional beam of light from oncoming cars heading into London as she heads away from it, and the miles go so slowly, and the Lake District is so far, and her husband is out there somewhere, and she's about to find out where, and she loves him so much and hates herself so much for bringing that woman into their world, their messy, grubby, broken and perfectly imperfect world. The world she thought that she didn't want, but which she now knows is the only thing, the only thing she truly wants. Her family, her home, her bad husband, his benders, the desperate, inglorious, ridiculous normality of it all. She wants it. She wants him. She wants that. She doesn't want this. This endless journey, her mother's knuckles white on the steering wheel of her car, the blinding lights, the grinding hunger in her gut, the sickening nothingness of it all. She wants Nathan back. She wants him back. And then she feels her phone thrum under her hand and she switches on her screen. And there is a message from a number that she doesn't recognize. Her breath bunches up in her lungs, and she presses on the message to open it up. And when she sees what it is, she knows. Even before the call that follows shortly afterwards from DC Albright, she already knows.
Lake Windermere, 5:27 a.m., the 29th of July, 2019.
I'm here this morning, just outside the beautiful Cumbrian village of Ambleside, on the banks of Lake Windermere, where overnight a grisly discovery was made. The body of North London man Nathan Summer, who went missing from a central London hotel in the early hours of Sunday, the 21st of July, was found in shallow waters just here a few hours ago. Police had entered a lodge just behind the lake and discovered items belonging to Mr. Summer. This instigated a full-scale water search operation overnight with the sad discovery made at around 2:30 a.m. Mr. Summer's family have been notified, are on their way here as I speak. The hunt for Josie Fair is still ongoing. This is Kate Mulligan, BBC News, Ambleside.
This is the voice message that Josie Fair sent to Alex Summer. It arrived 5 minutes before Alex Summer was notified of the discovery of her husband's body.
Alex, hi, it's me. I'm not sure what to say. I don't know what happened, what I was thinking. It wasn't my intention, none of it. The whole thing, I was trying to be helpful, trying to show you how much better your life could be without him. I was just going to keep him for a few days and then leave him somewhere to find his own way back to you. But it all went wrong. It's all a disaster. It makes me look like I'm evil, but I'm not. You know I'm not, Alex. That's why I wanted to share my story with you, because we are alike, you and I. We're both idealised wives with disappointing husbands. We've both been living in the shadows of awful men who chose us because of what we represented, not for who we are. We both had more to give, more to offer. And now Erin will wake up and say things about me too, and those things won't be true, Alex. You have to believe that. They won't be true. Everything I told you was the truth. We know that. You and me, you're the only person in the whole world I can trust to know the real me, Alex. Please, tell the world that I'm not a bad person. That I'm just a normal person coping with bad things. Not just the bad things I told you about, but other things. The thing I wanted to tell you about. The real end of the story. The darkest, worst thing of all. But I lost my nerve. I couldn't do it, and I wish I had, because now, because of this stupid mistake with Nathan, I've blown it. Now nobody would believe me anyway. So please, don't believe the things you'll hear. I'm so sorry, Alex. I really, truly am. Goodbye.
Monday, 29th of July. DC Albright steps back to allow Alex to peer inside the lodge. Alex wears paper covers over her shoes and has been told to go no further than the entry. The lodge is still a crime scene, but she had begged DC Albright to at least let her see it, the place her husband spent his last days. She has to know. And as she stands in the entrance, she is comforted in some strange and probably inappropriate way by the fact that the lodge is beautiful. It is modern and stylish and airy, with large windows on all sides, incredible views of the lake from the front and the countryside elsewhere. It resembles, in some strange way, Alex's house in London, with its aqua-themed cushions and copper kitchen taps and pastel-painted tongue-and-groove cladding. It even has a window seat in the kitchen area, overlooking the front balcony. It's gorgeous. Alex wonders at herself for taking comfort from this, wonders at herself and her values and every last aspect of herself as she has done constantly for the past week. Who is she? Why is she? What has she done? What should she do? Is she a good mother? Has she been a good wife? Good sister? A good friend? A good woman? Does she deserve what she has? Is she shallow? Is she irrelevant? Does she want to be relevant? Is she a feminist, or is she just feminine? What more could she have done for Josie and women like her? What more could she have done for her marriage? Her boy sits inside headphones every night with eyes wide, staring at a screen. Her girl cries over mean things said to her by other girls on the piece of plastic and glass she allows her to have access to. Her husband hands her cash as if she had a gun to his head. She sits in her recording studio pulling words out of women who've had a much harder life than her, who have suffered and survived, who have worked so hard and succeeded against all the odds. And there she sits in a £20,000 recording studio built for her as a birthday gift by her husband, whom she hasn't had sex with for over 2 months and who would rather go drinking in Soho with strangers than come home to her body offered to him like a cookie jar for good behaviour. And what sort of feminist rewards men for not behaving badly with offers of penetration? She is not a feminist. She is not anything. She is a trinket, a flibbertigibbet. And for a moment, yes, she can see herself from Josie's perspective. She can see what Josie saw in her. The big, gaping space in her soul that she filled with things that couldn't hurt her. And she knows why she agreed to work with Josie. Because, subconsciously, she wanted something to hurt her. And here she is now, staring at the last four walls her husband ever saw. And she is hurting. She is hurting so badly it feels as if fingers are inside her gut, shredding it into pieces, and she grabs hold of the doorframe with both hands and curls into herself and howls.
8:30 a.m. Erin groans and Roxy sits upright. She stares at her sister for a moment to see if she does it again. A second later, she does. And Roxy turns round to call for a nurse. The nurse appears and watches Erin from the other side of her bed, takes her pulse with her fingers, peers into her eyes, calls another nurse, who looks at the stats on the equipment that surrounds her bed and then smiles and says, "Well, hello, Erin. How lovely of you to join us." Roxy leans forward, closer to Erin's face, and sees a small smile begin to break out. "Oh my God," she says. "Fuck! Erin! Hello!" The smile grows bigger for a moment, and then shrinks again as Erin takes in the details of her surroundings. "Where am I?" she whispers. "You're in hospital. You nearly died." Roxy sees 1,000 pictures flood her sister's only just returned consciousness within the space of a few seconds. She sees the emotions play out as the memories flood back.
"Mum.
Mum is..." Roxy begins, but then stops. She doesn't know what to say. Mum is what? Mum is where? "Don't worry about Mum," she says, taking Erin's hand in hers and squeezing it softly.
"And Dad, is he?"
Roxy nods, tightly, and holds onto her tears. She needs to stay strong for Erin. "He didn't make it. But it's fine, sis. Be cool. It's fine. I'm here. So's Grandma. She's just gone to get us something to eat. We're here. And the world. Oh my God, Erin, you know how many people signed your vigil book on Glitch when you went missing? Like 100,000 people. 100,000 people signed it. Hashtag save erased. You were viral out there for a while. And now I can tell them that you made it. You're back. Erased was not erased." She's babbling, and she knows she's babbling, but she doesn't want Erin to fall into a dark pit of remembering. Not yet. Not this soon after waking up. She's pleased to see Erin smile at her words, and she squeezes her hand again. "You're a fucking legend, sis. Seriously, a legend." Her grandmother returns then with bacon rolls and bad coffee, and immediately puts them down when she sees that Erin is awake.
"Oh my God, Erin, you're awake. I can't believe it. I'll go away from you for 5 minutes and that's when you decide to wake up."
She sits on the side of Erin's bed and takes her other hand in hers, brings it to her mouth and kisses it.
"I've missed you so much,"
she says.
"So, so much."
"What day is it?" asks Erin.
"It's Monday the..." Roxy looks at the nurse, who says,
"The 29th.
"The 29th?
"I feel funny."
Roxy and Pat both laugh indulgently.
"I feel hungry."
They laugh again and the nurse says,
"We'll get something ordered for her. Soft food, isn't it, Erin? I hear you like soft food."
Erin nods.
"We'll sort something out for you. Some soup, maybe."
The nurses finish their examination of Erin and then leave, saying the doctor will come as soon as he can. Grandma passes Erin a cup of water, and then it is just the three of them, and Roxy and her grandmother chatter and burble, trying to keep the inevitable tide of darkness at bay for as long as possible. But then, a few minutes later, it comes.
Oh my God,
Erin says, her eyes filling with tears and terror.
What happened? What happened?
It's fine, says Roxy coolly. I'm going to tell you exactly what happened, okay? I'm going to tell you word for word.
Shortland News, London NW6, the 30th of July 2019.
We're approaching the garage now with Mr. Roberts, the owner of the block. Mr. Roberts is opening the main gate, and we're getting ready to go in.
Good evening. Earlier today, at around 11:30 a.m, the human remains of a young woman were discovered in the boot of a car in a garage in Kilburn, London, by the Metropolitan Police. They're believed to be those of Brooke Ripley, the young girl who went missing from her school prom in June 2014. The garage was leased by Walter Fair, the 72-year-old man found murdered earlier this week in his flat, while his adult daughter, Erin Fair, was found barely alive and tied to a child's chair in a cupboard. Erin, 23 years old, had last been seen by friends online whilst gaming in the early hours of Saturday, the 13th of July. A hunt for her had been carried out by her legion of online followers after they heard something strange happening during her last live stream, and a global campaign was ongoing to find out what had happened to her. She is told of surviving her ordeal by sucking on the strands of a floor mop in a bucket of dirty water left on a shelf in the cupboard where she'd been abandoned. Meanwhile, Josie Fair, Erin's mother, is being sought in connection with the suspicious death of Nathan Summer, the London estate agent found in the shallow waters of Lake Windermere earlier yesterday morning. Anyone with any information about Josie Fair or her current whereabouts is urged to contact the London Metropolitan Police at the first possible opportunity.
When we found Brooke, she was still wearing her white prom dress. The fabric disintegrated when it was touched. Literally just turned to dust, like a butterfly's wing. Poof. Sad. So very sad.
You okay to do this?
Yes, I'm good. Let's do this.
Abigail Curti is the mother of Brooke Ripley.
Brooke left home at about 6 o'clock. She looked amazing. I mean, she always looked amazing. But that night, in that white dress, and then she just didn't come home. I mean, we didn't know what to think. Brooke was a dramatic girl, you know. There were always tantrums and noise with Brooke. She hated my husband, her stepfather. They rowed all the time. She was rarely at home, and she had run away before. But this, I knew this was different. I thought it was to do with a boy. I didn't know anything about Roxy Fair. I knew there'd been a fight at school, but I thought it was just another school hallway scrap, you know. Very Brooke. I didn't know that Roxy and Brooke had been friends or lovers. I didn't know anything about Roxy. Didn't know where Roxy lived, and so I couldn't see any significance in the fact that Brooke got off the bus at that stop. And I had no reason, really, to think that that's where Brooke might have been heading that night. and God. I wish more than anything that I'd known. Then I could have told the police. They would have gone round and questioned them. That woman. Sorry.
That's okay. Take your time.
That woman would have been stopped. There and then. Before she had a chance to hurt anyone else. And Brooke might have been saved.
This is Roxy and Erin Fair. Erin Fair was recently diagnosed as having ASD. To compensate for living with her disorder in a toxic and dysfunctional environment, she developed various habits and coping mechanisms. These include talking in a very soft voice.
Our mother didn't want our dad to like us. And she didn't want us to like him. She wanted him all to herself, and she wanted us all to herself. She wasn't happy when we went to him, or had fun with him, or loved him. She wasn't happy when he was with us and tried to show us any love or affection. She controlled every element of our relationship with our father and his with us. It became worse and worse as we got older and older. When we tried to bring friends home, she would make them feel really unwelcome. And when Dad tried to organise fun things to do as a family, she would find ways to sabotage them. And obviously there were other challenges in our family too. The fact that Roxy had oppositional defiant disorder. My issues. She didn't let my father have anything to do with his first family in Canada. He used to have to sneakily Skype with them when she was at work, and one day she pretended to go to work but didn't. She sat at the bus stop outside, and then Dad looked up from his Skype call with his sons and saw Mum staring at him through the window. She didn't talk to him for days after that. So my dad just Skyped them from my bedroom instead. She didn't like us seeing our grandma because she was the enemy. She told us all these lies about her. That she used to be a prostitute. Brought tricks into the house. That she used to beat her and starve her. And of course we were small, so we believed her. But then our dad told us it wasn't true, that Mum was just jealous of Grandma because she'd been with Dad before her. But it got really, really bad when my dad got the job up north, when he was only home at the weekends and we were alone with Mum. She couldn't cope with us. Particularly couldn't cope with Roxy. She took Roxy out of school when she broke my arm, which, by the way, was kind of an accident. I mean, she did it in anger during a fight, but it wasn't done maliciously. But the social services tried to intervene based on things me and Roxy had said at school about our home life, and Mum pulled Roxy out of school for nearly 2 years and said she was homeschooling her, which was bollocks. She'd just let her watch TV all day, and then when Dad got back at the weekends, she'd leave all this fake learning stuff around the flat to make it look like she'd been teaching her. And she'd leave Roxy tied up to the naughty chair in our bedroom. Sometimes for like hours. And she said if either of us ever told our dad, that he would leave us and go back to his other family in Canada and we'd never see him again. Dad would come back at the weekends and she would act like everything was just so happy and wonderful. I think he knew. He did know. But he was trapped too. He had nowhere to go. He was getting old, and he'd already lost two of his kids, and he didn't want to lose us too. He stuck it out for as long as he could. Tiptoed round her. Did everything he could to keep her happy. And then one night Dad couldn't sleep, and he walked past my room and heard me online. I guess this was about 4 or 5 years ago. It was after I finished school anyway, when I was gaming full-time. And he walked in and all my followers were like, oh my God, is that your dad? And I was like, yes, this is Pops. And he said hi to everyone and he wanted to know what we were doing. And he pulled over a chair and sat down and watched. And after about an hour or so, he was totally into it. And it was great having him there because I talk so quietly, it's hard for me sometimes to create the sort of energy that gamers want when they're watching online. And he was there giving it all the energy, all the vibes. He was so much fun. And everyone loved him. And so he started joining in more and more. And of course, no, we could not tell Mum about it. No way. She'd have put a stop to it pronto. She'd have killed it dead. So Dad used to wait for her to go to sleep at night and then sneak in. And it was Dad who helped me monetize it all, got me on Glitch, managed my subscriptions, opened my bank accounts. He did all of that for me. He was the one who made me famous. And we were planning a trip to Nevada for a convention that summer, the summer he died. I was going to play in front of a live audience for the first time. Then we got home. I was going to move out, move down to Bristol to live with Roxy. I was breaking free. It was all happening. It was all within reach. And I think she knew it. She could smell it. And that's why she latched onto Alex Summer, made up that whole crazy story about Dad beating her and Dad abusing me. She wanted to disappear from her life before she lost control of it completely. Wanted to stop all the freedom and all the escaping. Roxy had already got out. She wasn't prepared to let me and Dad get out too.
And Brooke, what can you tell us about Brooke?
I was home with my mum. It was just the two of us. My father wasn't in London that night. He was working away, so I had nothing to do with him. Roxy was in Bristol, so it was nothing to do with her. And I was in my room in another world. But then I heard voices. A girl's voice, and I recognized it. It was Brooke, Roxy's friend. She used to be over a lot in the months before, but we hadn't seen her for a while. I went to my door and peered through. I saw Brooke standing by the living room door. Her body language was like she didn't want to stay. She was wearing this nice white dress. It was long, down to her ankles. And my mum was saying, she's not here, she's run away, it's your fault. And Brooke was saying, no, no, it's not my fault. I loved her, she was running away from you. And then I saw my mum just... She hit her. She hit her so hard. Around her face. And Brooke just stood there. She touched her cheek. She said, see? See, that's why Roxy ran away. Because of you. Because you're fucking mad. You're just totally mad. Roxy hates you, you know. She told me that. She hates you. And then Brooke picked up the hem of her skirt and turned, and I put my head back inside my bedroom and closed the door. And I heard her stamping down the hallway towards the front door, but then I heard this crack. This crash. And I heard this noise, this choking noise. I didn't dare look. I just stood there, my adrenaline pumping so hard I could feel it in my blood, listening to these sounds of struggle, of violence. And then it went quiet. And I did not leave my room for a very long time. Not for a very long time.
How long?
A very long time.
Did you tell anyone what you'd heard? Not even your father?
Not then. No. But recently I did. About a year before he died.
And what did he say?
He didn't say anything. He just sort of shook his head and sighed. I think he might have said, fuck.
And what happened after that?
Nothing. Nothing happened. Life went on.
And you never said anything to your mother?
No. I never said anything to my mother. I just cut myself off from her.
Why?
Because I was scared. Scared that if she could do that to Brooke, she could do it to me.
So what really happened that night? The night she turned up on Alex Summers' doorstep, claiming to have been attacked by your father?
They came home. I heard them at the front door at about 10 o'clock. It was quiet for a while, and then a few minutes later I could hear shouting. Really bad. I opened my door and watched through the crack. My mother was accusing my father of being an embarrassment, saying that he'd shown her up, that she'd been ashamed of him, and my dad did what my dad always did. He just sat there and took it. But then, out of nowhere, my mum called him a paedophile. She was screaming it at him over and over, saying that he had abused her and now he was abusing me. And then I heard my dad start to shout back. He was saying that he'd had enough of her, that he couldn't take it anymore, that it was the end of the line. And then he said she was mad. You're actually mad. And was telling her that she was stupid. And that was when I heard my mother scream. It was like an animal scream. And there was a bang and a crash, and then suddenly it just went quiet. I walked in and I saw my father on the floor. I thought he was having a heart attack. His hands were up against his chest. There was blood running from the side of his head, and I ran over to him and was going to try and, I don't know, try and resuscitate him or something. My mum just stood and watched. She said, "It's too late. He's an old man. It was always going to happen sooner or later." And she turned away, and I said, "But we need to call an ambulance." She said, "I already did. It's on its way." I said, "Why did you call him a paedophile? Dad was not a paedophile." And she said, "He had sex with me when I was 16. He was 43. What's that if it's not a paedophile? You put him on a pedestal, but he's nothing that you thought he was. He's nothing at all. Just a dirty old man. A sad, pathetic, dirty old man." And that was when I went for it. I said, "And you're a murderer." And I picked up the remote control and I ran to her and I battered her with it. Just battered her and battered her, and she didn't fight back. Just put her hands up around her head, and then suddenly she made this weird noise and she pulled herself up and she pushed me really hard, and I fell onto my bum, winded myself so I could barely breathe, and she put her foot into my guts and pressed down so hard, and I couldn't push back against her, and my father was groaning, trying to get to his feet, and she just kicked out at him with her other foot, and he was still clutching at his chest, making the terrible noises, and my mother, she stood above us both, and her face, there was nothing there. And she kept saying, "I am not mad. I am not stupid." She said, "It's you. It's you. You two drove me to this. You two. All I do is look after you both, and all I get is hate. I can do better than this. I can do better than all of this." And then I don't remember anything after that. Just woke up, and I was in the cupboard, tied to a chair. And Dad was, well, we all know what happened after that.
Part 4. Four weeks later. Nathan's funeral was every bit as horrific as Nathan's funeral was always going to be. Nathan knew so many people, and everyone who knew Nathan loved Nathan. The atmosphere in the packed crematorium was febrile with pain and shock. Unlike Alex, Nathan had known hurt in his life. His mother had died when he was 12. His little brother had killed himself when Nathan was 28, just 2 years before Alex met him. and Nathan had dragged himself out of pain and grief and made a good life for himself. He hadn't gone to university. He'd gone straight out to work and grafted hard for every penny he ever earned and was generous to a fault with the money he worked so hard for. And the drinking. It was so painfully crystal clear now to Alex. It was not about her. It was never about her. It was about him. About Nathan. About how he balanced out the delicate ecosystem of his damaged psyche. He didn't want Alex to see that dark side of him. He did not want her to see him that way. When he drank like that, to the point of oblivion, it was self-medication. It was relief. It wasn't good times and escaping from the battle axe. He hated himself like that, and that was why he didn't come home. Not because he didn't want to be with her, but because he didn't want her to be with him. Nearly 300 people packed out the crematorium near Nathan's father's house in Kensal Rise. Beyond the gates of the cemetery and onto the main road, the press and paparazzi kept a discreet distance. Alex wore a dress that she'd chosen to match the colour of Nathan's eyes. The shop assistant had called it artichoke. Alex didn't know what colour an artichoke was. She just knew that the dress was the same colour as Nathan's eyes, and that was the most important thing. The weather was pleasant that day, 4 weeks to the day after Nathan's body was brought out of the waters of Lake Windermere. Not yet bloated, thank goodness. Still recognisably Nathan. The month had been a blur, but that day felt sharp and clear to Alex somehow. Being with so many people felt right. And afterwards, at the wake, thrown by Nathan's company at a huge bar in Paddington overlooking the canal, with seats outside and bottomless champagne and a playlist put together by Nathan's best friends, and the children dashing about in summer clothes, and lively, urgent chatter and laughter, and people looking their high summer best. It felt almost as if Nathan would appear at any moment, in his element, loving every second. And when he didn't appear, it felt as though maybe he was at home waiting for her. And when he was not at home waiting for her, it felt as though maybe he was away on a boys' trip. And when, 10 days after the funeral, he is still not home, it is then and only then that Alex collapses. She lies on her bed, the day before Eliza's first day at secondary school, wearing her artichoke dress and clutching a pillow, arching and unarching her back as spasms of agonized crying rack her body at the realization of what she has lost.
Today, Nathan Summer, the husband of podcaster Alex Summer, has been laid to rest at Kensal Green Crematorium in North London. Dozens upon dozens of well-wishers, friends and family have flooded through these gates this morning to say their final farewells to a man who, it appears, was loved by many. But today, still, a month after his body was discovered in the shadows of Lake Windermere, police are no closer to tracing the woman accused of killing him with an overdose of barbiturates in a kidnapping gone wrong. Josie Fair, 45, was last seen on Thursday the 25th of July in the village of Ambleside, where she handed her dog to a pair of strangers before disappearing completely. Fair is also being hunted in connection with the murders of her husband Walter Fair, 72, and 16-year-old Brooke Ripley, and the attempted murder of her daughter Erin Fair, 23 years old. Since her disappearance, police have been following leads of sightings of Fair as far afield as northern France, Marrakesh, Belfast and the Outer Hebrides, but still, to this moment, her whereabouts remain a mystery. But for now, there is some small semblance of closure, at least, for Alex Summer, as she says a final farewell to her husband. This is Matt Salter from Kensal Green for the BBC.
This is Alex Summer in January 2022.
I couldn't come in here. Not for months and months. It felt so full of her, so full of Josie. So I just abandoned it. Focused on the kids, focused on getting my daughter through her first term of secondary school without a dad. On persuading my grieving son that I could be fun too, you know? And then a few months later, of course, the pandemic hit and life changed and everyone started doing things differently. Getting dogs, baking bread, writing novels, all of that. And I realized that it was all on me now, all of it. There was no life insurance policy, no income. There'd been a few thousand in our joint bank account when Nathan went missing, but that wasn't going to last very long. I needed to get a job. But of course, how can you get a job in the middle of a global pandemic when you're a single parent, homeschooling two children? I felt terrified, started making plans to sell the house, downsize. But then one night, a few weeks into the first lockdown, I looked out across the garden and there was this fox sitting by the door to my studio, staring at me. And he looked like he was issuing me a challenge, like a what are you going to do now kind of thing. Like are you just going to sit around feeling sad about everything, or are you going to fire up your engines and make something out of all this fucking awfulness? Because believe me, it was truly awful. But I knew that I had the makings, if I could only stomach it, of a truly unbelievable story. So the next morning, I made myself a strong coffee and took a deep breath and I unlocked the door to the studio and I thought, right, Alex Summer, it's all there, everything you need to make this happen. Hours and hours of recordings with Josie, with Roxy, with Pat. I had access to all the news reports online. I had recorded all my calls throughout, so I had my phone conversations with DC's Albright and Bryant. I had more than enough to create something completely unforgettable, something unmissable. I got in touch with Andrea Muse, the famous true crime podcaster, and asked if she would help produce and edit. My previous podcasts had been straightforward one-on-one interviews, all recorded in one sitting. Just needed polishing and a light edit before they went out into the world. This was going to be hugely different, involving complex editing skills that I did not possess. So with Andrea on board, I started that day. And by the end of the month, we had the first episode and it went live in late May. And yes, as you know, it went viral. Totally viral. After the first episode aired, I had people contact me directly, wanting me to interview them. Brooke Ripley's mother, Josie's friend Helen from school, Walter's son in Canada. So week by week, the podcast was becoming more and more complex, more and more multi-layered, more and more gripping. And then midsummer 2020, close on a year since Nathan died, I got a message from Caitlin. You know, Caitlin Rand? They'd just relaxed the restrictions then, which meant I could meet up with her face to face. So we arranged to meet in Queen's Park, just around the corner from my house. It was a Wednesday afternoon. I was quite terrified.